From the 30th of November to the 11th of December, the UN Climate Change Conference, COP21, will be taking place in Paris. Hopes are high that this will be the meeting where world leaders sign an international agreement to follow up the Kyoto Protocol with binding climate targets for 195 countries. The IPCC, which is the leading international body for the assessment of climate change impacts, has listed 8 major risks associated with climate change. 4 of those have either a direct impact on agriculture or are closely related to this sector. So how does climate change affect agricultural production and the sustainability of our food systems? And what are farmers and policymakers doing to curb it and to adapt to the effects of climate change that can already be felt? Martin Frick is the director of FAO's Climate, Energy and Tenure Division. Thank you for joining me. Do you think agriculture is being given enough attention in conversations around climate change?
Positively not. It's getting better slowly, but for many years, agriculture was seen as the sort of toxic issue, and that is changing dramatically, fortunately. I think it was a bit of the toxic issue, and I'm saying that in inverted commas, at the time prior to Copenhagen, where basically countries were afraid that a top-down legal instrument would interfere with their agricultural policies. But since we are now based on INDCs, the intended national determined contributions, it's back in the hands of member states, and it's quite encouraging to see that now in the about 150 INDCs we've seen so far, agriculture does play a prominent role. So I do see that the space we are getting in the negotiations is becoming bigger.
Can you give me an idea of the types of pressures climate change is putting on agriculture?
Well, most of the world's agriculture actually is rain-fed. When you think about climate change impacts, you think about tropical storms, extended droughts, hail, all sort of extreme weather events. And that's certainly true. More temperature means more energy in the system, and more energy in the system results in more violent, extreme weather events. That one is clear. But what few people do understand is that in order for a specific crop to grow and the yield to be what farmers expect, you actually need a corridor over a certain period of time of specific climatic conditions. And we are leaving this corridor. And it's simple things like, you know, changing rainfall patterns that makes it impossible for farmers to work on the basis of traditional knowledge. What you learned from your mother or your father is just not valid anymore. Or we just understand that nighttime temperatures do play a crucial role. That's what I would call a silent crisis of agriculture, which you see in reduced yields, but you also see it in reduced nutritional value of your harvest, and that is already happening today. There are forecasts, IPCC, the international panel of experts supporting the UN negotiation, estimates that by 2050 we might see 8% less yields, and bear in mind that by 2050 the world population will be much larger than today, so this is alarming.
How do these pressures on natural resources connect to other geopolitical and economic developments?
Well, I think the questions of poverty, development, and climate change are intrinsically linked. If you take a map of today's live conflicts and you take another map of extremely water-stressed countries, countries under stress for food production, there is an enormous overlap here. I don't want to oversimplify things. It's not that this is causing directly conflict. But if you think of an area like Lake Chad, where we are losing basically a lake, where entire water systems, ecosystems do collapse, it's quite obvious that this has an impact on people. You have about 75% of the poorest of the poor living in rural areas being directly dependent on agriculture. And I think we are crossing everyday human tipping points where it just becomes impossible for people to really stay on that piece of land. So what are they supposed to do? Other example, you have in places in Africa over many generations working agreements between pastoralists and farmers. So they both take advantage of the same piece of land peacefully. But if the stress increases, if the yields are lower, if there's less water available, then that might end up in a fight over resources, over water, over grazing ground. And then add to the mix a proliferation of small arms and you have a live conflict. Or, and let's not forget that food security is not only a question of the production, but it's about the availability and it's about world markets. So when you had the fires around Moscow in 2011, there was a law passed by President Medvedev at the time to ban agricultural grain exports because Russia was facing scarcity. That yielded to a spike of grain prices in the Arab world, which is in the Middle East, North Africa region, largely dependent from grain imports. And that spike in the prices of food was one of the triggers of the Arab Spring. So it's interconnected indeed. And with the international streams of trade of food, we can see the effects of one situation right on the other side of the globe.
What's the connection between climate change, energy, and land tenure in the context of building sustainable agriculture?
Let me start with land tenure. Land tenure is one of the things where FAO has been working very successfully over many years. And indeed, it's the basis, I would even say, of human activity. How are you supposed to work on a piece of land if you don't know who has the rights to work on this land? Who has the rights to have the harvest? If you plant a tree, it makes a world of a difference whether it's your tree or somebody else's tree. So adaptation starts really with land tenure. And let me emphasize particularly on the aspect of women in agriculture, because still in many countries of the world, women don't have the right to tenure, and yet they are bearing the brunt of the agricultural production. And that is increasingly so with migration kicking in even more strongly. It's mainly young men who migrate, leaving more women behind, and we need to address particularly women in the tenure questions. You also mentioned bioenergy. There is an old debate, I would say, dating from 2008-2009, that is caught in this sentence, tank versus table. So what's more important, to get fuel in the tank or food on the table? Well, I think we would all agree it's certainly food, particularly working for an organization that is all about food security. But there's another aspect which is really interesting and emerging, is you can take the waste from agricultural production and turn it into biogas. Biogas can replace traditional cooking fuels such as wood and dung to health benefits of particularly women and children for indoor cooking, but that also helps you to release pressure on forests, which are mainly used in some areas of the world for firewood. There's about one-third of the world's population relying on wood and dung as primary energy source. And so I think that energy is really at the core not only of fighting climate change, but really of bringing development to the world's poorest areas. So how does that come together for sustainable agriculture? It really is about closing the loops. Very simple, and often you get this knowledge with indigenous peoples and then it got somehow lost. What you take out of the soil, you have to give back. And once you produce biomass, you have to use it in the most intelligent way, which is food, of course, but then you work with residues from food production and you turn that into biogas. The residues from the biogas production becomes a fertilizer. It goes back in the field. But it's also simple food processing to reduce post-harvest losses and to make sure that what is produced is actually coming to the consumer. If you combine food losses, both on the post-production side, but also on the consumer side. Bear in mind that we use about 28% of the global arable land just to produce for the bin. This is insane and this has to change.
And what are some of the key challenges and progress points currently happening at this intersection of these elements?
I think the key challenges start with awareness. I said at the outset, agriculture was seen as a very difficult topic in the climate negotiations. But for me, it's very clear that we cannot get a comprehensive climate deal unless we really actively combine it with the sustainable development goals and with the fight against poverty. And for me, agriculture is the point of convergence of these two biggest struggles of mankind in the 21st century. This is where you can invest a dollar and it gets results both in climate action, but also results in reducing poverty. So one of the big advocacy bits of FAO is really to raise awareness for that and to try to funnel the billions of dollars that are now mobilized for climate change, to mobilize this money also for the benefit particularly of smallhold farmers, for investment in more clever and more sound agriculture, and not least, and I would be remiss not to mention that, to reach SDG 2. It's quite remarkable that mankind now decides to eradicate hunger, one of the biggest problems mankind has had for thousands of years. We decided to eradicate hunger by 2030. It's not going to be easier with stronger impacts of climate change that we're going to see, but it's absolutely doable, and it's doable with the right investments right up front. So we very much hope that in the climate negotiations in Paris, food security will get the political attention which is needed, and we are very much looking forward to 2016, where agricultural production will be much more at the center of attention of the UN negotiations. And we are really working towards climate finance sources to make our case of money being well invested in agriculture.
In terms of agriculture and food security issues, what do you hope will come from COP21?
Well, first of all, I hope there is a solid result in COP21. We are at a really interesting time. The community of states just agreed on the Sustainable Development Goals. And you know, they are very detailed. There are 17 SDGs, 169 indicators. But for me, the exciting thing about the SDGs as compared to the Millennium Development Goals from 2000 is actually that every country of the world takes on responsibility. So that means even if you are rich industrialized countries, the SDGs oblige you to more sustainable working. And I very much hope that in Paris we see the same spirit, that yes, of course, there is a question of historic responsibility, and yes, there is a need of climate finance to be lifted up by OECD countries. But I hope that out of Paris comes the understanding that this is our common problem. And even if you have a little bit to contribute, you should contribute, and you should invest time and energy and all of the government's activity into addressing climate change. For many of the countries of the world, that actually means first and foremost adapting to climate change. And again, for those who are in the most dire need for adaptation for climate change, adaptation actually equals food security. So if we can establish this link, and a bit of the political energy coming out of Paris going into food security will benefit the world's poorest, and ultimately it will also loop back as positive political energy into the climate process. Paris is not an endpoint. Paris is really a starting point.